All the Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Welcome to John Bowd's All the Rage here on www.traxfm.org. Yeah, it's been a really busy week all round. Miserable weather. So I was up in London yesterday and it just seemed to rain. And it's, postman's got a thing about rain. We got different types of rain. And yesterday was that rain that kind of pushed in your face and didn't stop. Sometimes we get hard rain, which is straight down and lasts about 10 minutes. But that annoying rain that is constant. Postmen know what I'm talking about. But yeah, we're here to talk about a number of things today. Particularly about attitudes, and of course, nostalgia, which is one of our favourite subjects. I like nostalgia, actually, but obviously when I do watch it on the TV, my kids actually wonder what I'm actually laughing at. I think the new comedy now is it South Park? That's it. My kids just laugh endlessly.
That show is 20 years old, though, to be fair.
There you go.
So that's nostalgia itself.
But then, I don't know, how often can you show Friends all day?
Oh, never. It's awful. Please stop showing that awful programme. I hate that programme so much.
John, I'll pass it over to you.
Awful, sad, pitiful, seedy people and their pathetic, rich flats. No, don't think. Oh, just crap. Yuppie scum. Yeah, so this week we've got a few subjects on the boiler, which are not exactly new. Well, they're not new at all. In fact, if anything, we don't seem to be able to get away from them. And I don't really have a tremendous amount of new stuff to say about it, but there's just a couple of things that have sort of stood out that I thought made them worthy. And also, as I said in previous weeks, as much as I love being a correspondent for All Great Things Trade Union, this show is becoming kind of boring because it was just going on and on about union stuff all the time. So we've always prided ourselves on diversity on this program. No matter what the actual social trend of the time is, so you know we need to get a little bit more interesting. Let's get back to our get back to our roots of me annoying the shit out of people by slaughtering the sacred cows, but doing it for a meaningful reason, not just for the sake of being smarmy. I'll come to that in a minute. However, yes, for our first subject this week, we're going to revisit something that refuses to go away, but which we never really say anything meaningful about: freedom of speech, but specifically the right to offend without consequence. The first part I don't so much have a problem with, the second part I do. The never-ending and ultimately meaningless discussion and fake debate over the right to say what you want, most often engaged in by right-wingers and washed-up celebrities who travel from TV studio to radio studio to podcast bedroom, talking about how they are being silenced for their un-PC, un-woke views of the world. It just never ends. It is almost like a literal treadmill, and at its heart is a total and complete lie of self-made victimhood. I would state clearly here that I'm actually not interested in talking about free speech at all. It's boring. It's one-dimensional, and I've been talking about it since I was a teenager because it was the first political thing I ever got into. I have zero interest in going over the same ground with the same people making a career out of being antagonistic, bigoted, and intentionally childish. Plus, this supposed debate has so many straw men, it looks like a scarecrow convention. You could be offensive in this country anytime you want to. You have the freedom to walk down the street with your middle fingers raised to everyone that you pass. But what we never ask is, what is the point of all of this? We never talk about the point of offence, how it may be related to wider social or even political movements of any description, how it can be entwined in the need to change things. Everyone has a right to be offensive, but social structures, media, traditions, attitudes, etc., dictate who and what you can be offensive about, or who you can be offensive to. And we know from bitter experience that this can go as far as inspiring hate crime and social intolerance that is suffered by others, not the person or the institution pushing the hate in the first place. We really need to discuss where freedom of expression ends and bullying and hate speech begins. Hate speech is a little easier because the law does give us some kind of ground in which to base it on, but it's also very easy to dance around. There's been various examples over the years from so-called British journalism, you know, the rags, where they've managed to just about not get done for intolerance and hate speech, but that's only because, as I say, they've done a very little clever dance around certain bits of language. That's not really acceptable to me. But again, putting aside the hate speech one, I think the bullying is a big one. You know, at what point, you know, if we all seem to think generally in society that bullying's a bad thing, we need to actually show that rather than fob off bullying by people's right to free expression, et cetera, et cetera. So if you remember, for instance, how during the start and the height of the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars, British society would not allow any dissent from the idea of the uniformed murderers of the British and US Army, that they were rampaging all over the place, killing people, to be seen as anything other than heroes. Their torture and killing was all down to following orders, which is, it was somehow impossible to find anyone in the chain of command who actually gave those orders in the first place. It was always never that person's fault and always somebody above them. Even when we saw people taking pride, taking photographs even, of the terrible activities that they were carrying out, you were simply not allowed to say that these things were bad people doing terrible things, like illegally invading and occupying a country and killing masses of their civilians. Equally, you could not discuss how many poor people end up in the armed forces because this horrible country closes off alternative opportunities to them, especially when they are from the neglected north of the country. You would be accused of some kind of working class snobbery or intolerance, which, of course, is ridiculous. And in fact, they should be left to, you know, kill at will, as it were. We even had an army general on the BBC television saying that Jeremy Corbyn ever elected to become prime minister, then they may take action, as he was considered by the establishment to be a threat. I can't believe that happened and we allowed it to happen. Nobody said a thing about it. If you ever wanted a huge signpost, a huge red flag, if you'll pardon the pun, saying that this country is not actually free, then you had it right there on national BBC television, while little Andrew Marr sat there and said nothing about it. Then there is the vile national activity known as sentimentality that governs so much of what we are allowed to express. See soldiers again, for one example, but and just the whole fantasies surrounding that. But I can remember the relatives of murdered loved ones, such as Helen Newlove, whose husband was murdered, suddenly being all over the place talking about wanting to bring back the death penalty for 17-year-olds and then becoming some sort of czar on victimhood and taking up a place in the House of Lords. Was she ever qualified to do anything, ever qualified to do any of these things? Or were we supposed to just accept someone making their career and getting into positions of power because her husband was killed and no one wants to criticise her for fear of seeming unkind or being criticised himself? As I said, sentimental crap. Our media just do not want to criticise her out of what seems like fear to me. And this has been one of many, many examples. Don't even get me started on Nick Cave. Now, I could go through all of these things, the self-made victims, the career makers, my hatred for the armed forces, et cetera, and no doubt I would offend plenty of people in the process. But these are my sincerely held views. They are part of what I believe are seriously needed to change society. There are plenty of people, organisations and political or social groups that I hate. I have no problem offending or upsetting them, but still I would not go out of my way to do so, mainly because I think it is pointless and immature. Why is it so difficult to actually take part in meaningful action that would directly benefit people's real lives? Again, I see the cheap offence industry as being nothing more really than a reactionary distraction from the need for systematic change. Another straw debate we allow is the idea that we should all listen to people we disagree with. I do not really do this, mainly because I've heard all that those folks have to say throughout my 20s and my 30s and nothing has changed. Not the subject, the views or the people saying them. You check back in with the same people every so often, but you know they are not saying anything they weren't saying when I was 25. And I'm an older man now and I've wasted enough of my life worrying about what the opposition says. Not to mention the fact that if you look at the more serious opposition, you know, such as those who, as I say, have a belief in the system the way it is now versus my belief that it must change, they are completely out of ideas, which is one of the other reasons why I believe that we need to just, you know, ignore them and override them. It's more than about time when everyone's starving, everyone's desperate, you know, everyone is being caused ridiculous levels of anxiety, stress and pain. If any right winger really believed in any of this, they would spend all of their time listening to Rev Left Radio or similar programs, only listening to leftists, communists, anarchists and people who believe in direct intervention in the economy. I've listened for years to free marketeers when I felt masochistic. And today, especially, as I was saying a minute ago, they have completely run out of anything to say. They are basically the arbiters of the destruction we're living through now, and they have no idea how to change that. Their view of the world has lost all ability to reinvent itself. So there is another reason to not listen to them, basically. Not to prevent them from speaking, but because their argument is tired and broken and they need a new one. I don't really get the argument for, you know, kind of making myself miserable and how that benefits the world, especially when I don't necessarily have a way of reaching out to them and responding. And even if we did, even if the two of us, three of us, five, however many people it is, went at each other on a program like this, well, so what? What does it achieve? Does anyone care? I'm not even sure I do, and it's my show. You know, I even think there are things here that I do not understand, and I hope to learn more about them. But that will never happen if we do not engage in the real issues that I'm talking about here. And instead, we just play this stupid back and forth game of who can be offensive. So that is why we'll continue to ask the question, what is the point of offence? Even though I never get an answer, I only get distraction. But I think it's a very important question. I think it's the kind of thing that a show like this is designed for. Dave, what do you think on this?
Yeah, sorry, I'm changing headphones. Do you know, I think people are offended by whatever. And I genuinely believe this, John. And I'm not a psychologist. But I think we're offended by things that at some point in our early lives affected us. Whether that be bullying, colour, whatever. And I think things that happen early on in our life affect us, you know, and we could all name examples. And you say, what annoys you? What would offend you? And people would say certain things that people say, generalisms, you know, even racism, you know. A lot of racists, especially sadistic racists, were abused as children, which is common, especially in a lot of early 80s, mid 80s mixed marriages in inner cities, where they took offence of their mother, for example, remarrying again or having a new boyfriend, and that person, and you know, statistics got higher in regards to mixed marriages, and we saw an influx of that, certainly in the 90s onwards, you know, where we, in the 70s, where you'd look twice, you know, you'd see a white woman with a black man, and everyone, we used to look at them in the 70s, now we wouldn't think twice, you know, you only have to look at the England football team, for example, as a lot of results of mixed marriages, but I think in the 70s and 80s, for example, you see a lot of, No reason racists, including educated politicians, by the way, are affected in their early lives by that, for example. And that's my belief. I think I don't think we're born with disliking something or offended by something. And you know what, John, having read the write-up to your show, this evening, I believe some people do like the attention.
Oh, completely. No doubt.
I think they genuinely like to stand up in a group, because everything, when you do corporate get-togethers and they break you into subgroups of four and five, you'd always get one person there want to be the loudest. And they'll often seek attention by saying, I'm offended by that, you know. Maybe I'm a bit nostalgic in the 70s, John.
Well, considering the way you just described it, I can't see how you can possibly be nostalgic for it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, in the 70s, we were just told to just get on with it, you know, and, you know, be spoken to and not say. I don't necessarily agree with that either, that edict, shall I say, but I'm just saying I think some people... Some stuff has happened in their life, and it stays with them. And I think, I'm being a psychologist, I think kids of big families, especially younger ones of big families, who, or maybe the older ones, but you know, there is a lack of attention. There is a lack of attention by a parent because they're working and it's large families, and they seek attention. But then saying that, I knew a lot of kids who were at school who were scolded and beaten. And it turns out that they've got a clinical... There was a clinical illness about them which we didn't recognise. Dyslexia was one in the 70s.
Yeah.
You were put into a thick class, because we were all told you were thick. Even teachers told you were thick. And it turns out that words to some people just looks like gobbledygook. And it's true. So, I don't know, but I wouldn't shout about it, John, you know.
No, I mean, look, I think
I wouldn't want to be a victim all the time.
No, but, yeah, but I mean, the whole attention economy, which is what a lot of this is about, and it's really of interest to me that people show up in this, if they're well known, if they're, you know, famous or whatever, around about the time that their career is taking a downturn. So if you're Morrissey, and you haven't made a listenable album since Ringleader of the Tormentors, then, you know, what else are you going to do except rank up all of that kind of slightly nasty intolerance that you had hanging in the background for much of your career and turning it up and exactly doing that entirely to get attention. I think you're completely right. And, you know, double that if you're Lawrence Fox, you know, the failed son of an acting dynasty, who's never going to get better than being the wingman to the bloke that used to be Inspector Morse's partner. And it's like, yeah, I'm never going to go anywhere. And my missus has left me and she's a substantially better actor than I am. Did a terrific version of Yorma in The Young Vic or the years ago. And yeah, you know, what else are you going to do? I know I'll become this arbiter of great traditional Britishness, which really means intolerant whiteness. That's the only traditions that they're interested in. And they basically, you know, the thing about offence is because we joke about this, but, you know, because it always comes out eventually, whether it's on one episode of Question Time or in anything else that they do, is this... At the heart of so much what these people want to do is that these are white people who want to say the N-word. That this is really, I mean, we joke about it, but honestly, that is where they are. They so deeply, deeply want to go back to old school of, you know, talking to people like they are less than you, than they are. You know, they are so small and petty, irrelevant and worthless. They can't even get their precious system of capitalism to transform the awful situations that we're all facing now. But they want to be able to look down on somebody else with absolutely zero effort. And it really, you know, laziness, self-victimization, desperate attempts at becoming or remaining relevant, and an intolerance towards anyone ever questioning them are absolutely fundamental. You know, you can find those points in any individual you want to pick who goes on this, the attention economy, you know, treadmill, the wagon, whatever way you want to say it. You know, they all have one or more of those traits in everything that they do. So John, and again, I just come back, like, what is the point? What is the point of all this? Where are you trying to go with this? And when the point of the offence is that, you know, it becomes dangerous for trans people to walk down the street, it becomes dangerous to walk into a public toilet when you need to go. You know, when it becomes, again, if you go back to the idea, like you say, of mixed race couples walking down the street and being attacked, tell me something. Where is the kind of the great liberation of being able to be offensive then? I'd like to know. Go on.
Well, just on that, and taking a liberal point of view, so say in America, which is more prevalent in America, I'm about to say, where groups like Me First and Black Lives Matter, where we have the predominantly right-wing element of America, which is your South, your Deep South, elements of Georgia, Atlanta, which says, or they're told, or they believe, and they still believe this vehemently, that being affirmative action means that being black will mean that they'll get the job first over a white person. Now, obviously, that's a shock, horror statement to make. And, of course, would say, well, God, that's terrible if that's the case. Even ethnic minorities would say, well, no, I don't agree with that. But there is a belief that that is actually happening in America, especially teachers' jobs and things like that. And there is a silent minority, it could be majority, of even liberals in America that stay silent but believe that that's happening, that they're going to get overlooked due to affirmative action. Or do you think affirmative action is, I should be treated differently because I'm black? I don't know, John. It is one to look at. What's your thoughts on that, John?
I think my thoughts on it is that affirmative action, whether it's of any use today, is I don't really know enough about it, but I'm happy to discuss it. I'm broadly in favour of it in a way, and that's because I see what it was designed for in the first place, which was to address the inequality in people getting employed. Now, firstly, and it's well worth remembering, in the country we're sitting in now, and America and plenty of others in between, it used to be perfectly acceptable for companies, perfectly legal, I think I would be accurate in saying this, I think I am, for a company or employer to say, I don't wish to employ this person because of their colour. So, and or because of their sexuality, or, you know, because of anything else, because of their religious identity. So we had to address that, and it needed addressing deeply. And what you have in America, as we all know, and there is, you know, wealth of evidence that you don't necessarily need me to point you to, but I probably can, of a country that is systematically designed as a white supremacist state. It's a very big state. It's a very powerful state. It's very powerful all over the world. It's not as powerful as it used to be, but it still has that ability and that power. So what America does matters, whether you like them or not, whether you live there or not. So what you had is a country with a system, you know, a deeply racist system. Maybe not quite as overt as the one in South Africa used to be, but then again, America's system used to be as overt as one in South Africa used to be, and the one in Israel is now. So it's very, you know, very pertinent point, I think, to kind of say, you know, about affirmative action. Now, you know, what does it mean on the ground? Is it the best policy? I don't know. I'm generally inclined towards policies that are more class-based than anything else. I think they are the most important aspects. And it's become very difficult for over the years to even see anyone in America admitting to the existence of a working class. They call them a middle class there, but actually you're getting more and more of people actually recognizing where they really are and where those things need to be. That's slightly clipped view on that, because I don't know where it is. It's not something I've checked in with for a while, so I don't know where affirmative action is at right now. But it's always been a right-wing bogeyman. And the idea that you would, you know, if someone else got the job I wanted to go for, I'm trying to work out why I'm supposed to be more annoyed about it if they're black. I never could really understand that one. Meanwhile, you know, I think this is a distraction from the things that really bother us. As we've seen this week, you know, the distraction of one particular prince, going on about his horrible family. I don't actually think most of what he said is inaccurate or wrong. I think it's fairly true, but it is basically a distraction from the issues we really need to address. And the biggest distraction in all of this is, of course, the and I'm not the first person to speak on this, and I'm not the smartest person to speak on this. See Matt Chrisman on that one. But I would like to just put my own point about this into the show. Embracing the politics of, I don't know what you would call this, but it is kind of a politics of vindictiveness, which is that accepting that nothing can change, accepting that we can't do anything, even though, as you say, if you listen to a lot of things, including this show on a regular basis, you would have heard almost nothing but stories of collective action, usually through trade unions, changing things a great deal for many, many working groups around the country and around the world. But, you know, the idea of you're all isolated, you're all alone. There's nothing you can do in your life. All you can do is try and find one group or another of people that you hate and make them suffer politically, make them suffer in their own lives more than you do. And that's where right-wing politics is right now. Whether it's, you know, the old-fashioned, I say it's quite old-fashioned now, hopefully it's not going to come back, hatred of Muslims, whether it's, you know, Jews run everything, or whether it's claiming that drag queens doing story hours in libraries are grooming kids. It's all hate politics, and it's all designed for, here's this group of people over there, make them more miserable than you are. Take all of your political energy, point it towards making other people worse off than you. Do not point it upwards towards those of us that are right royally fucking you and have done for the longest time and are now got to the point where we're destroying your healthcare, where we're destroying the ability to work, the actual incentive to work, because you can't even make enough money to live, who are not taking hold of the situation when you have crises of inflation, crises of paying for energy costs, etc. No, just have a go at the drag queen who's reading a story to your kids. And by the way, you take your kids to Panto every Christmas, there's nothing but drag queens there, all right, or a variation of it. It's so, you know, so leave, I mean, A, it's a terrible thing to try and do now, but B, you can't even get yourself out of the hypocrisy of that situation. So do me a favor. I hopefully that answered some level of your question.
Yeah, I mean, look, I always say, to deviate slightly, that those narrow-minded people, not necessarily narrow-minded people, but those who compartmentalise themselves into a corner, where we say, I don't know, no immigrants, neoliberalism, let's just put everything on the global market and hopefully, fingers crossed, it will gamble it all off and the markets do well. And if it doesn't do well, it will go down the sink, as you see now. Or no foreigners in this country whatsoever. And I always say, because that's what it is, isn't it? Those three things, for example, which is the big thing. And I always say, what's your end game? What's the end going to look like in regards to your view? And you think it will stop there. So if you say, well, I don't want any brown people in the UK, and then you achieve that, and you're going to keep it that way, or, you know, you're a neoliberalist and there's nothing left to sell off, there's nothing left to gamble on the markets, and it's all failed anyway, what's your end game? Or, say, for example, I don't want any gays living in my town, what's your end game? And by I say that, as a parent, for example, you achieve all that in your town, there's no LGBT community in your town, and lo and behold, your nephew's son comes out.
Yeah.
Neoliberalists, well, actually, this isn't working, we need to create something of our own and fund it ourselves. Would that be a possibility? And then, obviously, if you're anti-brown or anything, I know who you are, and it turns out that you've got all these buses sitting in the car park, and now your Anglo-Saxon people want to do that job. Is there an end game? Have you left the back door open? Well, actually, no, you know, we think that, you know, I'd just like to know what their end game, and my belief is, not necessarily neoliberalism, because I think it's just in the centre, and I think I don't think you believe in anything personally. But certainly those who are anti-culture, anti-colour, anti-LGBT, I personally think that you were bullied. in your early life. Or you were abused sexually or mentally by a parent or a relative. That's my belief. And I'm not a psychologist, because I know you weren't born like that. So why are you like that? Your hate.
Yeah, and also...
And you're not a victim either.
No, I think it's just the frustration of people wanting to, you know, they will always lash out at somebody lower down the scale than them rather than punching upwards. Because punching upwards is hard. I mean, you and I are doing, among others, are doing exactly that right now. And it's hard work. And it causes a lot of pain and anxiety. But losing will cause us even more. So, you know, that's why we're doing it. And I think that it's just a lot of people, they just, you know, they just don't have the guts, frankly. There are too many people out there are cowards, you know, if I'm going to be brutal and blunt about it. And if you look, you know, this hatred is bad enough, a hatred that allows you to dehumanize others. But just coming back to what you said at the top or near the top of the hour about, you know, the kind of hatred that was put towards mixed race relationships. Thomas Murr, who murdered Joe Cox, the MP, screaming "Put Britain first" while he stabbed her. That guy had exactly that scenario. His mother remarried a black man, and that sent him into a spiral of white supremacist, don't know what else to call it, but just psychopathic traits and behavior, because he just couldn't get over the fact that his mum had married a black fella. And that's an extreme end of it, but it's extreme enough.
I think it's extremely common. And when you get Mr. Robinson or whatever his name is, the Irish lad, coming out and saying what he did, you know, and giving out statistics on Muslims, you know, and you can see it, it's so passionate in his face, you know. I'm thinking, mate, who beat you up? Who gave you a slap? Yeah. Because I saw him confronted in Luton, and I've got a lot of friends in Luton. I'm not going to say anything more than that, Johnny.
Yeah.
And they waited for him because he came out and he thought we could just walk up and down and start giving out these statistics in Luton, in a part of Luton I wouldn't even go down. And they came out, the brothers. And I don't mean that disrespectfully, Johnny, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And absolutely cacked himself, and he literally ran away, and I thought, there it is.
Yeah, absolutely.
There it is.
Is that the right one? There's a great bit of footage of him looting when he's walking backwards and he trips over a traffic bollard.
Well, those brothers I know.
Yeah, good personally, for them.
And I wouldn't go down there. I wouldn't go down there. But I'm not saying it's violent, John. I'm just saying that they just defend themselves, and they defend families there. Yeah, because there was a lot of hate going on there.
And, yeah, they have a right to defend themselves. And also, just to underline, if any international listeners are tuning in tonight, or actually, if that matter, any British listeners, just to underline, you know, perfectly well, we're not talking about the idea of no-go areas. That's complete bullshit.
No, we're talking about they just look out for, because there was a lot of attacks and acid attacks there.
Well, good,
myself went down there to help out as well. Because I'm not tolerating that. And all I saw when the attacks were common, and I don't mean this, I saw a lot of white guys who were doing it, but they got to be in a minimum of 10. But when we got one of them on their own, well, a little child, John.
Yeah.
And they started saying to me that we're the victims. And I said, you haven't got a clue what it's like to be a victim. Get out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think I like that. I can see why we've come back to that subject, and I think it's very important to do so. I don't like to be repetitive, but sometimes we don't have a choice. Thanks for engaging that tonight. There's been some very, very good points, and hopefully the listeners have got something out of that. I should probably move on, because I've got two more subjects I want to bring up this week.
Well, I'm waiting for the nostalgia thing, because
I know you're waiting for that. There's one more bit.
go on.
Because I know that I don't like to eat into your show. And if I leave it till... Yeah, when it comes to nostalgia, you'll just be playing fucking Wigfield as a bed over everything I'm saying. I know what you're going to do. I know what you're going to do to me. I'm used to this by now. Anyway, So we've talked about, you know, we've talked about offence. Let's talk about shame. Shame is something else that exercises people's minds quite a lot, as far as it is a social phenomenon, but I don't really believe it works. So we hear a lot about the power of shaming people. It is something that is invoked by the self-made victims, the rich, the powerful, media creatures, and the political representatives of a dead and useless politics. We even sometimes hear people suggest that public shaming is a tool of worthy use, and we have all voiced our disgust at one person or other for their behaviour, which is perfectly normal. It's okay to be disgusted by the things people do sometimes, whoever they are. But I maintain that really shame does not work. And this includes within the, and this is a bigger subject than we've got time for tonight, but within the realms of exactly what actually cancel culture is. Shame achieves nothing and never has any meaningful effect on power. And as you should know, if you've listened to this show for the last 4 or 5 years, or how long we've been going now, we are all about what power is, where you find it, and how you take it on. So there's various examples, and I've narrowed it down to just a few that seem relevant for today. The Labour Party. Now, we'll be doing a whole show on this vile gaggle at some point, but let's just sum up a few issues here. They have allowed or even participated in the mental torture of vulnerable people who happen to be in their party and hold left-wing views. They signposted their own members for attack. See the case of Apsana Begum. They threw Jewish people under the bus to use them as political gain over their leadership of their own party, making up wild accusations of anti-Semitism, and then not actually addressing any real examples, which have always been higher in that party before and probably since, but I don't have the data on that, but certainly before Jeremy Corbyn was ever the leader. Keir Starmer lied with 10 pledges in his leadership campaign. That's not the only lie he's done. In the middle of the NHS crisis, we are seeing a humanitarian crisis. In fact, Starmer and Wes Streeting come out in favour of more privatisation and attacking GPs. So far, the Labour Party leadership has failed to meaningfully come out in support of any of the trade unions, despite the party being built by them in the first place. Their hatred of the working class was more severe under Blair, but Starmer has carried it on, aside from his natural failure to carry anything. But he's certainly tried to carry this on. So that's one example. The British government. Oof. Oh, where do we begin? Blatant union busting, rather than attempting to solve any of the problems people are actually facing in this country or listening to the workforce, who are the heart and soul of anywhere where they go. Not least all of the people who 2 years ago were being clapped on the doorstep every Thursday and are now being told they're greedy bastards who should have more laws enacted against them to prevent them from being able to go on strike. Still insisting on the political ideology of 40 years ago that has no political worth at all and is actively making people's lives substantially worse. This country has plenty of money, yet we allow our health service to be degraded by both parties to the point that it cannot operate. We allow homeless people to freeze to death in the streets, and the numbers of homeless people rise as landlords make millions from the housing crisis. 270,000 people in one recent report are reported to be in this position. One in three children go hungry. Workers are using food banks, including nurses, on their actual work sites. Any country of any worth would be ashamed of this, but Britain still tries to live through nostalgia and demand that you call it a great country for all of the horrible things we used to do to the rest of the world many years ago, and to some degree still do. Our power holders openly claim there is something wrong with you for not supporting the ethno-fascist apartheid state of Israel, not the other way around. See also Keir Starmer on this one. I see and hear calls for shame upon the perpetrators, but this is pointless because there is no real mechanism for holding them to account. You can go online, you can look on your social medias and get very, very wound up and angry about the things that they do and say this is absolutely shameful, disgusting and intolerable from, you know, as I say, Michael Gove to Keir Starmer, whatever it is this week. But actually, it doesn't amount to anything because it doesn't affect them in a material way. They still have careers. Part of the result is, again, to make us all feel disempowered. I could scream from the rooftops and tweet all day about how disgraceful I think Keir Starmer is. I will not move anything along. In the same way that this loser cannot land a meaningful blow upon the Conservatives, not during the worst COVID-19 pandemic situations when we were being run by literal clowns and deeply corrupt ones too, not even against the absent Prime Minister that we have now. For a party of reheated Blairites obsessed with skill and performance, he can't even meet this basic metric. But nevertheless, he's still here. The BBC, lastly, despite being exposed in pushing Conservative government propaganda in the run-up to the 2019 general elections and plenty of time before that, making a programme on anti-Semitism in the Labour Party that has been proven to be complete lies and continually platforming extremists and political wash-ups, such as some we were talking about earlier on. Just remember that little Tommy, the milkshake-catching pretend Irish boy, has been on the BBC substantially more times than I have and more times than I can remember. The BBC has never made a single apology, and they simply carry on with their publicly funded establishment cronyism. For God's sake, they still employ Nicholas Witchell. I mean, that man just looks like someone needs to put him down. God, I'm not talking about hurting. I'm not talking about physically hurting the man. I just mean he looks so sad and crestfallen, you know, which is what you get for spending your entire life sucking up to rich people who hate your guts. They should actually just be defunded for their anti-Semitism in the Labour Party programme alone, actually. So don't come to me when you want to cry about, oh, the BBC's got this, that and the other. I don't give a shit, mate. Let's not pretend that we will be taken in by any of the exact same shit. Next time, of course, it's exactly what will happen. Next time there's a general election that comes on, they'll put out all these things about the Tories being competent with the economy and, you know, workers asking for too much and Labour and the winter of discontent. Do you know what? If the last 13 years of Conservative government squash the shit out of anything that happened during one winter of discontent. Okay, so whenever anyone meets you with that, you have plenty of ammo to hit them back. That's the winter of discontent should never even be mentioned again. All of it is pretty shameful, but to what ends? Well, what do you think on that one, Dave? Before I put you out of your misery and jump into nostalgia,
I just think it's all a joke, and the fact of the matter that we've got the worst government. Doesn't matter what worst is. I think we've got the worst government and the worst opposition. All I would say to people is to front a neoliberal type leader. That's one thing to do it in the 90s. I think that's another thing to do it in the midst of, I mean, we're on our knees as a society. Mm. And neoliberalism from the 90s just does not cut it. Okay, it's gone and it's not coming back. And we need, if we got an extreme right, and you voted for an extreme right, I'm sorry if you're from and you have mixed race children and things like that, which is the vast majority of us do, and you voted for an extreme right, don't be offended. You did. And as John has said, don't come running to him.
No.
Right? And that's what we got. We're in a mess. We're in a mess. And it's a joke. It's become Apathy UK. And it's a joke. And we've got 30 million people that don't even vote. That means 30 million people don't agree with any political party. You've got a problem, Britain. John?
Yeah, and don't be dismissing those folks as being apathetic or apolitical, especially the young. Because right now, the young are substantially more political than the runt that sits in the middle. I don't want to rump, I should say. I'm not doing any kind of ageism here, but at the same time, I will respond to things when I see them. And the kind of idea, you know, for years and years, young people were told they're apathetic. What they're actually is underpaid, overstressed, and underappreciated. And far too many of the kind of pseudo-liberal property-owning centre, who are the only ones who really don't want anything to change, were far, far too dismissive of young people and their purple hair and their avocado toast, when in actual fact, you know, they're not the problem, you are. And again, you know, it's kind of weird to talk about shame in this, because to me, to sort of say it's pointless, but it's like, what can you, in a situation like now, what can you do? Well, you know, if on, and I mean literally in the situation, in what you're listening to right now, what I'm trying to broadcast right now, because you have far too many points, and I have far too many conversations like this, which kind of result in discussing these issues and then just all sort of coming to the point of going, well, it's shit, isn't it? And it's like exactly that. You don't really have anything to say. You know, if I was funnier, you know, we could like crack jokes about it. And there's some great, as I say, you want that kind of stuff. You know, you listen to Chapo Trap House or Trash Future or people like that who are great at, like, you know, taking apart a situation no matter how grim it is, but also, you know, taking the piss out of Elon Musk or whatever in really effective ways, and they keep me very entertained and sane. But I can't do that. So it kind of makes the whole thing even more pointless, because you can't, it's not even like it's material for something that I could, you know, build a better life on, perhaps for myself and others. Not to be, you know, mercenary about it, but anyway, we've just got under 15 minutes to go. So I suppose I better launch myself into that ever-present subject.
I was going to play in the Minder soundtrack to this bit, but...
You can. There are worse programs and better ones. You got... You like a bit all that ITV4 shit, don't you? I can just tell. Yeah, the professionals and Minder. And...
Yeah, so I do series link Minder.
Yeah.
Because only because I like the cars.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, couldn't afford any of them then, and I certainly can't now, John.
I was interested in looking back over. I thought about this the other day. This is going back a year or more now. Who can tell with all the lockdowns? It was easy to lose track of time. But it suddenly reoccurred to me, you know, this program, Prospects, which I hadn't seen since I was a little kid. Apparently, it only ran for one series. I remember it had a theme tune by Mungo Jerry and Stephen Olson. Excuse me, Gary Olson, dearly departed now, was in it. And there's a few episodes of that on YouTube. And as I say, I'm not one for revisiting, but I'm kind of interested. It sort of came from kind of the same place as like Boys from the Black Stuff, that kind of programming. And I thought, I might check that out again, because that was about, you know, about the country where it was in the 80s, you know, with Thatcherism shitting all over the working class and making it impossible. And it's good that YouTube steps in and does a job where they, you know, where it's not possible to put things out on DVD in good quality, you know, good quality restorations with loads of extras, such as the BBC's Ways of Seeing program or Mark Thomas's comedy products from Channel 4, then it's good that people slap it up on YouTube, even if the resolution's a bit shit. It's good to be able to access that stuff. That's not nostalgia. That's learning from your past. That's a different thing. And those two programs I mentioned there, Mark Thomas and John Berger's truly colossal Ways of Seeing, I can't recommend enough. Anyway, with all of the nostalgia and the damage done is the title for this bit. With all of the intense situations facing us in the here and now, you might think we would focus on what can be done about the failing capitalist system and all the damage it is doing in these, as it spirals out of control, making us all poorer and substantially more vulnerable. But sure enough, the interests best represented by distracting us have found other ways to express their desire to keep us occupied with the irrelevant through modern technology. A recent article by Dan Hancock's in The Guardian, caught my attention as it detailed one of my least favourite cultural diseases, the one known as nostalgia. That empty public and personal pastime that cripples the lives of so many of us and has contributed so strongly to the moribund cultural state of Britain today. Hancock delves into a Facebook page called Memory Lane UK that posts various photos of reminiscences specifically from people who were children in the 1970s, but among others, discovering what he calls, in his words, the strange case of the proper bin men. I'll let you look up the article and you can get a bit more detail on it. At the time of writing, Hancock notes that a particular post in regards old-fashioned bin men had attracted almost 7,000 likes, 3,000 shares, and 900 comments, plus inspired many imitations. Hancock discusses the nature of this post, and his words to quote, "To their admirers, proper bin men embody a lost post-war idyll, and the decline in national character can be seen in the appalling state of the modern-day counterparts, who are rotten in spirit, in character, and in service," end quote. Just like to underline that obviously that's not what we think of bin men on this show, because they're some of the people that keep us from getting more diseases and rodents running through the streets, so thank you very much for your service. Aside from the horrible judgmental attitudes here that might be expected from the sort of people using a god-awful Facebook page like this, are there really people in the world who think rubbish was cleaner in the good old days? Bin men still work hard in conditions that are tough but necessary. Hancock notes the page attracts phenomenal interest and enthusiasm from older Britons on Facebook. Actually, most people on Facebook are old now anyway. Where, in his words, a whole constellation of meanings and memories are projected onto them. Pride, anger, resentment, wariness, ennui, and fond, at times very touching, personal recollection. I know I probably pronounced the word ennui wrong. I don't care. It's my show. That is at least from the ones who were there on the page. Then you have the ones that make really no sense. In our day, you only had Lucozade when you were ill. Okay. So no one should drink it unless they're unwell. I mean, it does fuck all for you when you're sick anyway, so I'm not quite sure what your point is there. I know it's too expensive. I know that much. I don't even know what that's trying to say, but hey, maybe some of you can help us. This paragraph stood out for me, actually, the following one. Hancock writes on the site here, quote, "There are no births, marriages, or deaths here on the Facebook page. No wars, no world historic events, no great men and women of history. There is no post asking who remembers the Cuban Missile Crisis or who remembers the sinking of the Belgrano. Those questions are too remote from ordinary life. Over here, we have abacuses and Listen with Mother to talk about. The banality is the point. This is a world where a picture of three butter knives can attract 1,300 comments of fond recollections and reflections." End of quote. Now, I started off here saying yet again how much I hate nostalgia, so I could be looking for things here to highlight my already existing hatred. Granted. But we come back to this so often for very good reason. Nostalgia is a tool for breaking the spirit and fostering a belief that not only is your life worse now, but there is no future you can work toward where you will be better off, either in yourself or your community, or for that matter, even in your own family. Everything good has been done and nothing new or better can come next. And I sincerely believe that this mindset is deeply poisonous. Okay, this is the Heart FM mindset. This is also related to semi-skim milk, but that's another argument altogether. This is just designed to make you shut down and shut off, spending all of your time online, wishing you had your past back, and I don't know, maybe taking a tranquilizer or two in the evening. This is all the most basic return to childhood stuff. Something is lost and cannot be found, will not be found, no matter how hard you look, how much you want it. It is all gone and we can only move forward. And that is a fact of life, whether anyone likes it or not. Nostalgia is not going to save you. The strange thing about nostalgia is the effect. While most people seem to be able to understand pleasure in far more rational ways, right? From everything from going for a run to busting your nut. You can do these things with no loss of joy, despite knowing exactly how they work, mentally speaking, you know, knowing what parts of your brain that they actually feed and give joy and pleasure to. You can understand how that works, but it does not take away from the basic act of being able to enjoy them. It's still good. Knowing how they, how they produce pleasure. But for some reason, nostalgia completely envelopes people. Like a drug, you become only capable of existing within the realm it allows you to. It is not that I never experience any of these effects of nostalgia in very small doses, but I know what they are. I can identify the effect, so it does not overcome me and it doesn't cripple me. And as again, I think, you know, I can say this for you, Dave, I think you're in the right. You know, watching an old program necessarily to kind of check out the cars or whatever is not the same as kind of wallowing in this with a tear in your eye. The present situation the country faces is affecting substantially more people than it might normally, not least because of the proletarianization of the country's economy. One aspect of this is a noticeable increase in trade union support, at least at a surface level. We should really be working on this and other aspects of creating unity in order to go forward and create a better land to live in. There is nothing for us in the past except to learn from all the things we did wrong. By the way, just in closing on my point here, I just also recommend Dan Hancock's book on grime called Inner City Pressure, which is really terrific and reminds us just how fucking awful the Blair years were. Anyway, Dave, that's my bit. What do you think? Defend the nostalgists.
No, I mean, I can't really defend it for the reality of it, because the reality of it was, you know, nostalgia probably where we are today socially, economically and every other way, politically set up what we are today. So let's not go on about the good old days, but all I'm saying was there's some great music, some great hip-hop, some good non-sensitive comedy, lovely cars, gas-guzzling cars, big ugly things, which my missus just thinks I'm mad because I love the old cars, especially the old Cortinas. But also saying that that economic and those political decisions that were made, certainly in the early 80s, have set us up where we are today. I'm not blaming any political party. It was both sides or three sides.
It was mostly the Conservatives.
Yeah, I'm going to be the middle on this one.
No, don't be so in the middle that you basically deny political facts.
Well, no, it benefited few.
Yeah.
Benefited indeed. Very few. And future-wise, and if I was a 17, 18, 19, or 25-year-old or 30-year-old, I would lose sight of politics, because if I left school in the early 2000s, I would be blaming people politically, saying, well, I'm in debt after leaving the seat of my education. And I want to blame someone. And if that's a political solution that you've made me like that, why the hell should I vote for anyone, John?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, again, that comes back to where we started this evening. Yeah. I mean, why would you vote for any of these people? Make people, make them work for your vote. It's not something you give to a party because it's the same one your dad voted for, and it's not something that you give to them because in the past they were exactly what you were looking for politically, but they're not now. You know, it's, and I understand that. And look, you know, obviously I want to see the Tories absolutely destroyed and crucified. I don't want to see them beaten by Starmer's Labour. I don't think they're fit for power. And more importantly, they won't be beaten because that man can't win anything because he's deeply unpopular. What you're finding is actually, it's an incredible situation. We've thought this for a while, and they actually released data to prove it this week. That is, what you've got now is a battle of unpopularity. And the next government could be made up by the group of people that are not as unpopular as the other one. And again, you know, that's crisis stations. You know, that is a... Again, I don't want to say the same thing over and over again because it becomes boring to hear, but that is what we're at. You know, the crisis in this country is a crisis of greed, and the political crisis is a complete incapability of dealing with the situation, with the reality of what is facing you right now. And I don't know what else to say about that. You know, that can't go on. It is completely inappropriate, and people are suffering. No, even further, people are dying. You know, the Conservative Party managed to murder a shit ton of people during the COVID-19 pandemic, and they've got away with it. And now they're doing the same thing by underfunding our healthcare system, by not actually addressing it properly. And you can't allow that to go on, and you can't just retreat to a world of being wistful about a time, either A, when you were young, or B, a time before you were born. Because that's not going to help anyone. It's not going to solve anything. And really, it's nothing more than shooting heroin into your arm, really. It's basically the same thing, yeah. Because you're trying to disconnect. And I understand that desire to disconnect. Believe me, more than most people who could tell you, that who could be having this conversation, right? I know the desire to disconnect. I know the desire to get away from the rest of humanity. But you simply don't have that option, either realistically in real life or when we're facing the horrors that we're facing right now. You need to get in the game. And it's going to be tough, and it's going to be ugly, and you're going to go up against very powerful opponents who are clinging on by their fingernails to the positions of power that they have occupied unfairly for a very long time. So they're going to get nasty. But you just get nastier. And you have all the people to help you, to support you. You know, we're all part of a wider communities in taking this on, whatever your persuasion, whatever your position in life. But do not, you know, sink into the pathetic, you know, I can't even think of the right word for it, of just like, oh, you know, there's been no good comedy since Blackadder or some bollocks, you know, which isn't even that funny anyway. So, you know, you need to get over that and move forward. And we are all the rage and more than happy to help you do so. That's it, Dave. If you want to add anything, please feel free.
No, John, thank you very much. And we'll chat next week.
Thanks, everybody.
All the Rage with John Bowd. www.traxfm.org